My guest, British journalist William Shallcross, has been called a chronicler of catastrophe. In his new book, The Shah's Last Ride, he tells of the downfall of the Shah of Iran. For 38 years, the Shah ruled Iran. He hoped to move the country toward Western modernization and away from Islamic fundamentalism. The Shah maintained his dictatorial rule through torture and intimidation by his secret police force, SAVAK. In 1979, the Shah was overthrown in a revolution. When he fled the country, he found that none of his once devoted allies would offer him refuge. His unsavory reputation as a particularly brutal despot made him too great a political liability. Dying of cancer, the Shah was shuttled from country to country seeking medical care. William Shawcross's new book tells of these final days of the Shah. William Shawcross also chronicled the catastrophe of Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge in his award-winning book, Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. Shawcross has also reported from Syria, Lebanon, and Ethiopia for such papers as the Sunday Times of London, the New Statesman, and the Washington Post. I asked William Shawcross why he wanted to write a book about the Shah of Iran, since he was so reviled by most of the world.
Yes, well, that in itself was interesting, and I thought that was one of the things I wanted to look at. Why did this man, who had been an extraordinarily significant ally of the West in a very, very strategically important part of the world, much more strategically important than Vietnam, in a way, I mean, everywhere, I think, why did he become, in the 1970s, such an extraordinarily important symbol throughout the Western world of a vicious police state?
Mm-hmm.
And one answer to that is, and perhaps the most important answer, that he ran a vicious police state. And SAVAK, the secret police in Iran, was a very nasty organization which tortured and killed those who opposed the Shah or were even thought to oppose the Shah. And that's one of the areas I go into in the book, the nature of SAVAK, the secret police in Iran. At the same time, however, I think it is true to say that that SAVAK, loathsome though it was not by any means the worst secret police organization in the Middle East. And the Shah killed opponents of his and tortured opponents of his, and so do other regimes in the Middle East, which haven't received nearly so much opprobrium in the West. And that I found interesting. For example, the regime in Syria, run by President Assad, who's an extremely cunning leader, in 1981, they leveled the town of Hama, where there was a fundamentalist insurrection. In one weekend, they killed 25,000 people. Now, the Shah, in all his years, did not kill 25,000 people, I don't think. Certainly, that's a figure way in excess of those obtained and published by Amnesty International, which are probably the most reliable.
Does your, and maybe sympathy is too strong a word, but certainly your sympathetic portrait of him, have to do with the fact that, in a sense, he is someone that the West can identify with because he had this love affair with the West, and I think the West had, for a time at least, a love affair with him, and there was some understanding of each other, where I think with many countries in the Middle East, there isn't that kind of understanding.
Well, I think that's a very good point. Yes, I think there was that. He was educated in Switzerland at a very sort of rich and cosmopolitan private school, where Richard Helms, incidentally, also went to school in Le Rosé, not at the same time as the Shah. But Helms then became ambassador in Iran during the Shah's last years and played an important part. Certainly the Shah's inclinations were all towards the West, and a lot of Iranians have very close connections with either Britain or with France in particular, and have done historically. And French culture perhaps is even more important in Iran traditionally over the last century than British culture has been. And a lot of French Iranian intellectuals see France as the sort of cultural homeland from which they're not perhaps exiled, but to which they always like to return. And that obviously is very discordant, if you like, with the Muslim mass of the people. There is this, has been, under the certainly in the Shah's time, this upper layer, if you like, upper crust of top Iranian society, which governed the country, which was inclined towards Europe and had very little sympathy for the Muslim tradition and history of Iran. And the Shah himself was always trying to deny that tradition. He was trying to insist upon a version of Iranian history which virtually excluded the history of Muslim influence in Iran. It was absurd.
How was he able to consolidate his power? Because he was really installed by the British. This was in the 1940s. He was a young man. He was 22 years old. He was, I think, by all accounts, pretty much of a playboy. Fairly ineffectual as a leader. I don't think he was installed because of his leadership capabilities. How was he able to consolidate power?
Well, he was installed, indeed, as you say, as a young and rather feckless young man, as the son of his father, and his father had already consolidated power and had set up the instruments of government in Iran. He was a very effective, ruthless dictator in the 1920s and 30s. And so the Shah inherited the instruments of power, if you like. But it's certainly true that it wasn't for 10 or 12 years that he chose to use them very strongly. And in 1953, he was overthrown in a revolution and then restored in a coup d'etat, which was, to at least a large extent, financed and arranged by both the British Secret Service and the CIA. And it was after that, after the 1953 restoration, that he was encouraged by his allies to exert much firmer, harsher control, if you like, upon Iran, and to centralize government much more firmly, and to try and, in the 60s at least, modernize the country after what was thought, what was then the prevailing Western image of how a country should develop.
He said, "I owe my throne to God, my people, and to you," referring to Kim Roosevelt, who was an official with the CIA. Did that dependence on the CIA continue until his fall?
Yes. I'm not sure that dependence is quite the right word, but certainly a close relationship between the Shah and the CIA did continue throughout his the rest of his rule, and the CIA station chief would have constant access to the Shah, at least as much access, perhaps more than the ambassador in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, and the relationship was close, and the CIA had listing stations along the Soviet-Iranian border, which were considered to be extremely useful, indeed vital at one stage to the United States, and several U.S. presidents, particularly Nixon, and to a lesser extent Carter, considered those listening stations able to look over into, from the mountains, over into southern part of the Soviet Union and to detect missile tests and so on. They were considered to be a vital strategic requirement.
I'm curious about his love affair with the West, and obviously it extended into the upper classes there, but whether it was pragmatic, because it was a way, I suppose, of bringing the 20th century, at least the Western version of the 20th century, to Iran, or whether it was that he really did identify with the culture and the politics of the West.
I don't know about the politics, because he didn't want to have a democratic society in Iran. He saw the only government as for Iran to be an absolute monarchy like his own. Though having said that, by the end, I think it's fair to say that by 1976, he had come to realize that the repressive society, which had become much more repressive in the 1970s, was not working. And he wanted to turn the throne over to his son, and he began to talk about the example of King Juan Carlos in Spain, who had, as you know, and still has had, extraordinary success in leading Spain from the fascist dictatorship of Franco into a constitutional monarchy. And the Shah began to ruminate about whether he could be a Juan Carlos in Iran. And in 1976 and 77, his last years of power, he did begin to curb the excesses of SAVAK, the secret police, and torture was outlawed, and political prisoners were freed. And that, of course, that liberalization coincided with Jimmy Carter's election and Carter's insistence upon human rights throughout the world, and particularly in the amongst U.S. allies. And that policy was diametrically opposed to the policy which Nixon and Kissinger had wished upon the Shah. There was this extraordinary visit in 1972, which I think was a crucial one in terms of the Shah's degeneration, if you like, and the development and the disarray that Iran fell into in the 1970s. Nixon flew from Moscow, where he'd been the first American president to visit the Kremlin, and he'd signed the first of the SALT agreements. And he was flushed with this triumph, and he'd just a few weeks before been to Peking and met with Chou Enlai and Mao Zedong. And it was a few months before his re-election, before the 1972 election. McGovern was going to be the candidate, that seemed clear, and Nixon was was on an enormous high, at the peak of his power, I suppose. And he came to Tehran, and he embraced the Shah, literally, and hugged him in their private meetings, and said, "You must protect us. You must be the policeman of the Gulf. You must be the guardian of the West in the Gulf." And the Shah was overjoyed. He'd always sought the approval of American presidents, and never really won it. Looking through all the papers that I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and elsewhere, it was clear that Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson had all had misgivings about the Shah.
Well, they'd kept a kind of cautious distance from him.
That's right. They had never given in to his demands, which they thought extravagant demands, for massive militarization of Iran. They thought that this was a very bad way for the country to develop.
And what Nixon did was really to offer the Shah a carte blanche to buy whatever weapons he wanted. And, of course, the Shah was, or Iran was, awash in money from oil.
Well, that happened slightly later. But, yes, Nixon gave the Shah a blank check. And Kissinger came back to Washington and filed off into the bureaucracy some of the most extraordinary memoranda that had ever been directed to the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, saying, from now on, the Shah and the Shah alone will decide what Iran needs in military weapons. We will give him, or sell him, rather, everything that he wants, short of nuclear weapons. And that has never been done before. The United States has never before, or never since, suspended judgment as to what a country needs or what it should be supplied with in U.S. national interests. The Shah was to determine that from now on. And there was quite a lot of resistance in the bureaucracy to this policy.
Including the Pentagon.
Including in the Pentagon, especially in the Pentagon, I would say. But Kissinger overrode it. And the Shah was given this blank check. And then the next year, the oil price rises was shot up by 400%, and Iran was awash with money. And so he could buy far more arms than had been envisaged when Nixon gave him this promise. And yet the blank check was not rewritten. And so in the 1972 to 76 period, massive armament systems came into Iran with and the distortion in the economy was extraordinary.
My guest is British journalist William Shawcross, and his book about the Shah of Iran is called The Shah's Last Ride, The Fate of an Ally. I want to backtrack just a little bit, because what the Shah tried to do, and I think this was carrying on his father's ideas, was to bring literacy, certainly more literacy, to Iran, to provide more education and medical care, to provide greater freedoms for women, for women's independence. How far did this revolution actually extend?
Well, his critics would say that it didn't extend any distance at all, that it was a cosmetic revolution. The Shah called it the White Revolution, the Shah People Revolution. But it had successes. It certainly had successes in the 1960s, and Iran did advance in the 1960s, and there was a growth of literacy, and women's rights were extended, certainly. They were extended much further than has happened in the 1980s under the Khomeini regime.
Did it extend, though, down into the lower classes?
Not enough, no, I'm sure, not enough. The Shah's people would say, well, that's because he didn't have enough time. But I think what happened was that in the 1970s, his interest in that, in the domestic development of the country, was diverted, and he became much more interested and indeed obsessed with being the West's policeman in the Gulf, which we asked, both the British and the Americans asked him to, a role we both asked him to perform. And his attention was diverted to foreign affairs, and really what went on in the country became a very secondary interest to him, and that was the tragedy for not only for him, but principally for the Iranians.
The poor, the peasants of Iran, not all, obviously, but many flowed into the cities because I suppose that was where the money was being spent. Did this, in a sense, create kind of a revolutionary feel because of the contrast of people who, as you say, were awash in money and others who had nothing?
Yes, vast oceans of money flooded into Tehran in those years. A lot of it was very corruptly dispersed. And the rich and the middle classes, the new bourgeoisie, built themselves huge palaces and large villas in the more salubrious parts of Tehran. And the builders were these peasants who had flocked in from the countryside looking for work, and all they could find was work on building the villas of the rich, and they themselves slept on the sidewalks in the evening. And the only succor and the only sort of people that they had to turn to for help or for spiritual or indeed material assistance were the mullahs, their traditional teachers. And this was a very important part, I think, in the build-up of tensions towards the revolution. And then in 1976, as I say, the Shah began to relax the grip of the police state. Nixon and Kissinger, or Nixon in particular, had actually encouraged him to keep a very tight police state running in Tehran. It was the most extraordinary fact, but the President of the United States was actually endorsing the methods of Savak in 1972.
How much did Nixon know about what Savak was doing?
Well, that's very hard to say, because I don't know what Nixon actually knew. It's certainly true that that information was available in the State Department, and I've seen State Department reports about Savak's methods and about the growth of a dissident underground in the early 70s. However, Savak's methods got much worse after the Nixon-Kissinger visit. The worst time for torture in Iran was 72 to 76, and then the Shah eased off in 1976-77 and allowed the expressions of dissent and stopped torture, and the lid blew off the cauldron in 77-78, and he was unable to contain it. And to his credit, he resisted the demands of many of his generals and some members of his own family that he simply shoot down the demonstrators in the street and kill as many thousands as was necessary to crush the revolution. And he said, no, a king cannot survive on the blood of his people.
And yet, that's such a contradiction because of Savak. I mean, he was willing to terrorize his people for his kind of power, but he wasn't willing to fight them in the streets.
That's right. Well, it is a contradiction, I agree. The Shah is a very contradictory personality. That, I suppose, brings us back to what we were saying at the beginning, that Savak was an organization which sowed enormous fear, indeed terror. But if you look at the numbers of the people who were killed, and I it's terribly difficult to express this because it sounds as if I'm defending the fact that it only killed a few people, but the amnesty figures, and I think amnesty are the most reliable assessors of these, suggest that there were a few hundred killed in the 70s by Savak.
What about torture?
And torture. I think the figure for killed and tortured was something like under 2,000. But you'd have to... I've got my book with me.
It feels very macabre to talk about.
I know, I hate it. And it's the sort of discussion which is endless. And I was talking about this to a lawyer friend of mine last night and saying, well, what is the... We were trying to work out where do you draw the distinction between, say, the Syrian regime, which kills 25,000 people in the weekend, and the Shah's regime, which perhaps killed 2,000 people over a 4 or 5 year period, which is worse? And he was saying there is no distinction. And I said, right, that's, I think you're right about that. But then what do you say about the Khmer Rouge, which killed 1 million people over a 4 year period? Are they different again in kind? And where is the distinction? Talking about numbers is obscene, and it's very difficult to do. I mean, but I suppose what I was trying to say is that Savak was a horrible, vicious police force for a number of years. And then the Shah himself, under pressure from the West and under pressure from his own realization, I think, that the police state wasn't doing what he had thought it might do, he did relent in 76-77.
My guest is British journalist William Shawcross, and we're discussing his new book about the fall of the Shah of Iran. It's called The Shah's Last Ride. Shawcross is also the author of the award-winning book Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with British journalist William Shawcross about the Shah of Iran. I do want to talk about Khomeini. And he first became known in Iran in 1960. And part of his how he came to be known was his protest over the white revolution, or certainly the Western influence that he saw in Iran. Why had the Shah really excluded religious leaders, considering how much power they had in the country?
I think he was following on from his father, who had determined that no modernization could take place in Iran unless what he saw as extremely conservative and retrogressive influence of the mullahs be destroyed. And the father wanted to create, and the son after him, a modern 20th century secular society, not a religious society, not a theocratic state. And the mullahs were resisting this from the 1920s onwards, resisting the emancipation of women, resisting a secular educational system. And neither father nor son had any time for them. The Shah used to be extremely contemptuous of them. He used to call them smelly ragheads. Mm. He made no secret of his disdain. He was a cosmetic Muslim himself. He prayed, but he paid very... but it was lip service.
Well, part of what religious leaders were so offended by was the corruption that they saw around them. And it seemed as if the way the Shah consolidated his power and the way he turned to the West and to foreigners for advice, that there was really no way that his advisors could get close to him. And in a sense, they had to turn to the enormous amounts of money to get kind of economic power because they really were denied political power.
Yes, nobody got close to the Shah, and this is one of the extraordinary tragedies. And one of the things I was looking at, really, I think that my book isn't a book about Iran. I don't pretend to be an expert on Iran. It's the story of a king in the 20th century surrounded by a court of mostly flunkies. And you could use that rather dismissive term, perhaps, not only for the Iranians around him, but also for the foreigners around him. There was almost nobody amongst his advisors or those with whom he saw who dared to contradict him.
Well, they also didn't tell him he was dying of cancer.
Yes, that's a very strange metaphor, isn't it? It's extraordinary. And my book is the story of the Shah's last years of his death and of his journey in exile through the tarnished rim of the Western world. Because what I thought was extraordinary was this great ally of the West, then finally with no place to go when he fell. And he fell largely, of course, because of his own misunderstandings and his own delusions about Iran. He knew very little about the country by the end because nobody spoke to him about it. One of the few people who did talk to him was his wife. Mm. And she did try to say, look, SABAK is a grossly abusive organization. And she did plead for individuals who had been imprisoned by SABAK. And she did have success. But she said to me when I talked to her, look, a wife cannot always be saying critical and pessimistic and gloomy things to her husband. She's got to say some cheerful things too. But she was one of the few conduits to him, one of the few people who dared to talk up to him. And as such, she was resented by many of the men around the Shah. And many of those who felt that the Shah should have been much tougher and more brutal in 1978 in crushing the revolution blamed the Queen's liberal influence on him.
Why do you think the United States did not anticipate the revolution, and not just the revolution, but the fervor of the feelings of revolution?
Well, it wasn't just the United States. Nobody did. The British didn't. Even the Israelis, who have extremely good connections in Iran, and the Israelis were terribly close to the Shah. There had always been a very close relationship between Israel and Tehran in the Shah's days, a relationship which indeed has been restored, as you know better than I, in recent years with the sales of arms from Israel to Iran, which became known here as Irangate. Nobody predicted the fall of the Shah. Nobody understood the depth of anger that was being generated in the country. And partly, as I say, it was because the Shah refused to allow Western embassies to do that sort of intelligence work. The ambassadors and others were not allowed to have contact with the opposition, with the mullahs. And at least if they did so at the pain of the Shah's displeasure, which was thought to be commercially, if nothing else, undesirable.
Towards the end of his life, he literally was a man without a country. He was a pariah. He died in Egypt, having been denied the ability to live almost anywhere in the world. But when you look back at his life, in a sense, is this a just end for the kind of brutal sort of dictator that he was? And at the end of your book, you say he behaved with courage and dignity. And I must say, I find it hard to sympathize with him that way.
Yes, I don't think one has to sympathize. I was just trying to tell a story of the fall, if you like. I hope it doesn't sound conceited if it's a sort of Shakespearean story. Shakespeare would have told it a lot better than I, but it has that sort of dimension of a Lear-type tragedy of a man who brought upon himself.
But aren't tragedies about great men with a fatal flaw or kind of a tragic flaw?
Well, certainly I think the essence of tragedy is that they are men with flaws, that's certainly true, or women with flaws. And they great, I suppose, is a matter of definition, whether they are great in meaning wonderful or great in terms of powerful. But the Shah was certainly a powerful man who was not a monster. He was not an evil man. He was not a Hitler. He was not a Stalin. He was not a Pol Pot. And I think that distinction must be made. He was a dictator in a very vicious part of the world. And as dictators go in that part of the world, he was not the worst. And perhaps this was a misunderstanding, and on the West he became a symbol of the worst sort of vicious dictatorship, partly because he was our ally, and we put our allies to higher standards of conduct, perhaps, than we do our enemies. And perhaps that's why someone like Saddam Hussein of Iraq or Hafez Assad of Syria has never achieved the symbolic hate figure stature that the Shah in the West, that the Shah achieved with great ease.
Do you feel he was betrayed? Because in certain ways, that's politics, and certainly that's international politics, is, you know, you get your own, you take care of your own at almost, you know, almost at any cost.
Yes, no, I don't think he was betrayed. I think he betrayed himself, and I think that his own delusions were at the basis of his fall. And he didn't understand Iran. He only flew around the country by helicopter, by plane. He never went out into the streets of Tehran. He was a man who wore very resplendent uniforms, and you had this feeling of him as a man in vast uniforms and a very small man within the uniforms. He was not, as I say, I think, a Stalin-type figure or a Pol Pot figure, but he had these extraordinary delusions of grandeur, or somebody was talking to me about it yesterday, entitlement, and he believed that he was entitled to govern by divine right almost, and it was absurd because his father had established the dynasty only 50 years before. It wasn't even a monarchy that went back hundreds of years. And the Shah was isolated in his palaces by the corruption, by corrupt and fawning courtiers of both Iranian, both from within Iran and from without it, by a corrupt family from which he did nothing to restrain. I don't think he himself was enormously corrupt, nor his wife, certainly not in the way that the Marcoses were, but certainly they did nothing to restrain others of the Shah's relations, who symbolized dreadful greed and acquisitiveness and treated the country like a business. And the Shah did nothing to stop that, and that aroused enormous and justifiable anger.
William Shawcross, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Shawcross's new book, The Shah's Last Ride, The Fate of an Ally, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.